And it's easy for people to sit back and, yeah, say, send them guys. But when they have to say, yeah, I'm going to send my son or daughter, then they have to think a little harder.
It makes a real difference when people know you're a veteran.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
This is a time of trial for Iraq, for the United Nations, and for the world.
We believe those who've seen war know a lot more than the politicians today, all of whom managed to avoid military service when they could have served.
The resolution gives UNMOVIC and the IAEA a new, powerful mandate. In other words, anyone, anywhere, anytime.
With lovers, teeth, and justice for all.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, November 11th, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The study of war is the topic du jour this Veterans Day 2002. As President Bush pushes the nation and the world to the brink of war against Iraq, President Saddam Hussein is expected to accept the UN Security Council resolution that requires his nation to disarm and submit to weapons inspections. The Iraqi parliament is recommending Saddam reject the proposal, while the Arab League is urging him to sign on. He has until Friday to decide. If the U.S. launches war against the people of Iraq, that will raise to 64 the number of countries with U.S. military bases and troops. Among those opposing military attacks on Iraq are veterans who have fought in wars throughout history around the world. In a special discussion on this Veterans Day, Peace Watch spoke with four vets against the war. During a roundtable discussion earlier today, we discussed when it's appropriate to suit up for war.
Happy Veterans Day to everyone.
Well, happy Veterans Day to all of you.
Happy Armistice Day.
Yeah, regardless of how I personally feel about war and peace issues, I wanted to thank each and every one of you who have served this country in the noblest of ways by putting your life on the line for the country. At the same time, however, it occurs to me that there are some wars that really needed to be fought for the good of humanity. To stop Hitler, for example, or to end slavery in the U.S. But then, almost the moment those words are out of my mouth, I realize I'm sounding like President Bush with his axis of evil justification. So I guess I'd like to begin the discussion with how did each of you, all of whom have served as veterans, arrive at your current anti-war position? Now, we have representatives from World War II, the Vietnam War, and the Gulf War, and Ellen, you served in South Korea after the 1979 coup. Paul Brelsford is our guest. You served in World War II, Paul. You're from Salem, Massachusetts. Can we begin with you? What's a good veteran like you doing at an anti-war discussion?
Because as a veteran, having seen the results of war, I feel it's the obligation of those of us who've experienced the murder, the terrible things that happen to the economy of a country, to do everything possible to prevent war beginning by dealing with the issues that brought the confrontation to that point.
David, the Vietnam War was probably the first of the unpopular wars. There was no ticker tape parade for the veterans when they returned home from Vietnam, and yet I always felt the soldiers hadn't really been told the truth and they were just doing what they believed to be their patriotic duty. How did you arrive at this point in your thinking?
Well, first off, for the soldiers that fight wars, no wars are popular. And when I went to Vietnam, I believed the government. My dad had been in World War II. My grandfather had been in World War I, so I thought you were supposed to, you know, trust the government, go with the flow, and go serve. So when I went to Vietnam, in the United States, they used to give us these indoctrination sessions, how we are going to South Vietnam to help the people there fight against communist aggression. When I got to Vietnam, they told us, you can forget all the stuff they told you in the United States. You can't trust any of these people. Any of them could be the Viet Cong. They're not really people anyway. They're gooks. So any cause we had left to fight for, they told us forget. And we had to do a 12-month tour of duty. And really, we were fighting just to make it home alive and help our buddies get home alive. And that's what that war was about. And when I came back to the United States, A lot of guys, when they came home, their attitude was, listen, that was a bad year, that was a bad experience, I'm going to just try and forget it and put it behind me, go on with my life. I've made a decision that I was going to speak out and tell people what I saw and become involved in the anti-war movement, because I knew that they were just going to keep drafting my friends and my brothers and other people year after year for a lie, and that I had a responsibility to come back and say it's a lie.
Of course, there's no draft now.
Now there isn't, but, you know, we have, in reality, the military is made up of what I call the poverty draft, because most of the people that go into the service are going in because their economic situation, they can't go to college, and they get recruited on the basis if you go in the military, you can get these college funds. A large percentage of people are in for that purpose. So that's a poverty draft.
Mm-hmm. Ellen Barfield, you were stationed in South Korea after the 1979 coup. What is your experience with war and peace and service in the military for the U.S.?
Well, since I served at a rather between times, yeah, there wasn't what one could call a full-fledged war, but what I did in Korea was be an occupying troop, one of 40,000 that have been there ever since the early 50s, when that police action, that was never called a war either, but when that happened, I was occupying that country for United States economic interests. And Dave is absolutely right about the poverty draft. That's why I joined, to get the money to finish college. You know, I found out it was a passel of lies, but by then it was too late to back out. And actually, I did get my college degree with Army money, but that's pretty dadgum rare.
Mm-hmm.
It really doesn't work out very well for most folks. The money they say you're going to get is if you qualify for certain narrow conditions and circumstances, and if you put in a lot of your own money, and if you get an honorable discharge, which a lot of people don't. I mean, there's just so many ifs that really very few people get that money that they trumpet all over the place you're going to get if you join.
Mm-hmm. Rick, you're a veteran of the Gulf War.
I am.
And we're still focusing on that region of the world with this next war. What is your message to would-be military personnel and to the public at large?
Well, several items have come up during the discussion here that kind of catch my attention. One is the economics of it, you know, the economics of war, and the poverty draft, as Paul mentioned. The economics of war, I would submit, you know, we talked about what's a good war, a popular war or not, you know, and I would submit that none of them are good. They are all have basis in the economics of it and the enrichment of the peoples at the very top of the heap at the expense of the peoples at the bottom, which are typically us. We really have to look at, really have to understand why wars happen. We have to look at what the conditions were that got us into them in the first place. Obviously now with the Persian Gulf, at our present consumption of 20 million barrels of oil a day and our dependence on foreign imports of oil of approximately 50%, it's not too awful difficult. It's not rocket science. Just follow the money. You know, our rates of consumption, we cannot produce that much oil locally. We don't have incentives for, you know, cleaner power and those kinds of renewable energy resources. So, again, it boils back to economics. So.
Mm-hmm. But when is the time to try and figure it all out, before or after you put that uniform on? I mean, in hindsight, it's kind of easier to see.
Well, it is, and to the young people today, I would say it is somewhat tragic that we don't have a real live draft, because if we had a real live draft, it would motivate people for some selfish reasons to join us in the streets, as to say, you know, I don't want to go. You know, the same thing that happened in Vietnam. The things that we have to watch out for is the wars are going to happen 10 or 20 years ahead of time. This is, okay, what are we doing? What are we doing to countries now, in terms of embargoes or economic destimulus or sanctions, those kinds of things that set the stage for these things to come up in 5, 10, 20 years.
David Klein?
In terms of the, you know, like what's just mentioned about the draft, you know, I know that some people have different views. I actually agree with what was just said, is that I think if, you know, our country's supposed to be based on the idea of the citizen soldier defending it, you know, and a professional army, or at least what they try to present as a professional army sort of goes against that. And it's easy for people to sit back and, yeah, say, send them guys. But when they have to say, yeah, I'm going to send my son or daughter, then they have to think a little harder. You know, we had a meeting yesterday in New York City, a veterans meeting. We had over 150 veterans came to protest war with Iraq and opposed to the Attorney General tearing up the Constitution with acts like the Patriot Act, so-called Patriot Act. And there was a young man came to the meeting. His name is Wilfredo Torres. From Rochester, New York, 19 years old. He had joined the Army, and he went in because he didn't even want to go to college. He wanted to learn to be a cook. He got sent to basic training at Fort Benning, and they told him, forget about being a cook, we're going to give you a rifle and send you to the desert. His response was to go AWOL, and he came to our meeting and made a statement saying that he was opposed to going to war. He's turning himself in today to try, and he's with an attorney. But he wanted to just become a cook. And they said, no, we don't need you as a cook. Now we need you as, they told him, we're going to give you a rifle and send you out in the desert.
Mm-hmm. David, today is Veterans Day. What kind of celebratory activities, if any, have you planned for yourself today?
Well, as soon as I'm off this radio show, I'm going to head on over to New York because we're having a contingent marching in the New York City Veterans Day Parade, Veterans Against War with Iraq. Mm-hmm. We have signs that we're carrying that say, another vet against war with Iraq. And we'll be marching members of Veterans for Peace, Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and other groups. And we are continuing to put out this message and rally our fellow veterans because we believe those who've seen war know a lot more than the politicians today, all of whom managed to avoid military service when they could have served, and now they're all hot on sending someone else to fight.
Well, I hope you're going to have your battle gear on going into that environment, speaking anti-war messages.
Well, we've been marching in the New York City parade for many years. We have been an active veterans peace movement in the New York area for a long time. And know, you know, there's some people that may be hostile, but a lot of people take the attitude of, hey, if you're a veteran, you got the right to your opinion.
Mm.
A lot of veterans feel that way.
Have others of you experienced that same attitude as well? Ellen, what has your experience been?
Dave's right. It makes a real difference when people know you're a veteran. Me being a woman, of course, they don't assume that I'm a veteran, but when I tell them, it can make folks be a bit more respectful. They figure I've done my service, I have a right to my say. And frankly, I think it's unfair that they don't think everyone in this country has a right to their say. I mean, we do have the First Amendment. We're supposed to have free speech. But it does make people pay a bit more attention that when they know that I have had military service. And I use it. I mean, my goodness, you have to use every opportunity that presents itself. So I certainly use it when I can.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it gets complicated because I didn't serve in combat, probably wouldn't have anyway, even if there had been a war when I was in, but there wasn't. But you asked earlier, what can people do as citizens, not just as veterans, but as citizens? It is our responsibility to pay attention all the time to what our government is doing around the world and the pressures it's bringing to bear, because I think it was Rick was talking about, we have to know what comes before we get to an all-out drums of war situation. Why are we being drummed into another war? What's behind it? What's going on? Of course it's about oil in the Gulf. And we need to know that and pay attention all the time and weigh in as citizens all the time instead of just suddenly being called up again and have our emotions raised so that, yes, let's go to war wherever they tell us to.
Well, that's a lot to ask of an 18 to 22-year-old, basically, is who we're talking about here.
The ones who are liable to go to war, that's true. It's not their opportunity so much. They're still very young, but it's all the citizens, their parents, for heaven's sake.
Paul, you fought in World War II. Would you consider that to have been a just war? And I assume that you feel that going into Iraq is not a just war.
Well, in World War II, we sort of set this up. After World War I, we made conditions in Germany so bad that the Germans decided to build a huge military-industrial complex, and Hitler took control of that. What we're doing now, we are enlarging our military-industrial complex to the point that they're beginning to say, oh, you've got to keep us busy. You've got to develop better and better weapons. We want to control space. I'm concerned that the Iraq war is just the beginning. The Iraq war is a war to control the oil in Iraq. But I can assure you that Iran and the other Arab countries are not going to stand idly by and allow us to take over their region.
Rick Blumhurst, a veteran of the Gulf War, why are you speaking out now?
If I don't, who will? Mm. You know, that's the thing. You know, if I stand silently, you know, while I watch, if I have knowledge of these things that are going on, silence becomes consent for me too. And I'm, you know, again, everyone has to go ahead and settle with their own conscience. You know, the folks that were involved in wars for whatever reason, many do come out, and many of my fellow soldiers, when they got out of the Gulf War arena, a couple that I was particularly close with, where they just, again, just wanted to put it behind them. Just go on, I just want to get my life back and go on. And I find that, again, to my responsibility, to my children, to the, you know, the young people around me, society in general, everyone, need to have a greater understanding of these issues. You know, we get this whole thing drummed into us from childhood on up. You know, you recite the Pledge of Allegiance upon command, you know, every morning when you go into school, and we get the Star Spangled Banner played at us at every baseball game, football game, everything like that. I mean, the whole patriotic zeal, this fervor that is built into us, has conditioned into us, diving under our desks, the communists are coming, all these kinds of things like that just kind of add to it.
Well, not the communists now, but the terrorists are coming.
Well,
somebody
is coming. Look over there. There's somebody coming to get you. The boogeyman is coming to get you. And when we come find out, the boogeyman actually was just, you know, other human beings like you and I, you know, 18-year-old kids on either side of the line killing each other. So why must it speak out? It says, well, why do we have to have all these 18-year-old kids killing each other?
So I think that if there were someone on this call that was in favor of going to war to Iraq, they would probably pose the question, so if everyone felt the way that you all do, then we wouldn't have anyone to defend this country.
Well, what are we defending ourselves from? Iraq is not a threat. They were not a threat to the United States in 91, and they most assuredly are not a threat to the United States now. The only way Iraq is liable to go off and hurt anyone, and it's going to be people in the region, not the U.S., is if they are pushed to the wall, which we're going to do if we invade. Iraq is no threat to the United States, and the nations around it don't think they're threatened by it right now.
You know, I think that the question you asked is important, you know, and I think that what we really get into is what are the legitimate defense needs of the United States as opposed to what do we have today. You know, we support the men and women who are serving in the military. We were there before. We know the situation they're in. We're not against military personnel or the military. What we are against is having young people being sent to fight and die in a cause that isn't worth fighting and dying for. There have been times in our history where I believe that military conflict was necessary, the revolution, the Civil War, and I believe that World War II was necessary. In fact, it's a shame that the United States wouldn't support the struggle against fascism when it took place in Spain. We work up in New York with veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade who went there to fight, and at that time, the United States turned their back on them, but those wars may have been necessary to fight. Even if a war is necessary to fight, it's still war, mm-hmm. and you still come back with the emotional and physical wounds, all the damage. And there's got to be a better way. That's the first thing. You know, you asked earlier about, well, how do you tell this 18 and 19-year-olds about what the big geopolitical scene is? I go to speak in high schools a lot. And a lot of times young people will ask me, after I talk about my experience, they'll say, are you ashamed or do you wish you hadn't gone to Vietnam? And I always tell them, the biggest mistake I ever made was as a young man when I got my draft notice, I thought I wasn't capable, I wasn't smart enough, I wasn't adult enough to look at what was going on and make decisions for my own life. And then I found other people making them for me, and they were decisions that were harmful to me.
You've got to speak out for what is right. And yes, I'm sorry that I said earlier that the 18-year-olds can't make their decisions. Dave's absolutely right. Of course they can. They simply need to continue to pay attention. Know what is going on. Don't just wait for the drums of war to come along and then get caught up in it. Pay attention all the time. Know what you think is a cause worth fighting for. I don't agree that any war is worth fighting for, frankly. I think there are other ways to work out disagreements among nations and among peoples. But you can't just wait until your leaders say, hey, we have to go to war now, because the reasons they want to go to war are going to be for selfish economic reasons, not for defending the nation reasons.
And, of course, Ellen, I think mothers and fathers have a responsibility to counsel and to caution their youngsters and to be politically active to make sure that they're not being sent into wars where they will help to affect collateral damage. Paul.
Collateral damage, yes. I would like to state that what we are about is to ensure, if we can, that there are no more veterans of wars.
Yes.
But, you know, in collateral damage, the real veterans of any aggressive behavior on the part of a high-tech nation like ourselves are going to be the women and children who are targeted by the bombs that go from some 35,000 feet. And I have a little poem which I wrote about that if you want to hear it.
I'd love to.
Collateral damage. Please, God, help our brave pilots avoid the embarrassment of eye contact with persons beneath them as we in the world watch on millions of television screens their computer-guided bombs glide gracefully down to blast chosen targets to bloody shreds. Help them drown out for us within the roar of their jet engines the shrieks of the wounded in humble Afghan homes as neo-liberators turn their villages to rubble, from a safe height, of course. Before our planes are hit by defense missiles and their crew's blood begins a metaphorical drip, 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 slowly earthwards like red snow from the blackened cockpits of sleek stealth bombers spiraling down on our televisions, to hopefully alert George W. for War Bush an attack on Iraq is not the answer. 9/11 urges Americans to act now to stop war and end racism. With a million-person march to the White House, where the sound of our stamping feet will tell Mr. Bush, no, 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 no war on Iraq.
Veterans for Peace. Paul Brailsford of Ipswich, Massachusetts. David Klein of New Jersey. Jersey City, New Jersey, Ellen Barfield from Baltimore, Maryland, and Rick Bloomhurst of Kansas City, Missouri. To commemorate Veterans Day, President Bush laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier this morning at Arlington National Cemetery. Throughout the country today, people displayed American flags and recited the Pledge of Allegiance. But ever since the start of the Bush administration's war on terror, many peace-loving Americans have felt somewhat ambivalent about notions of patriotism and love of country. We present today a special audio collage produced by Carolyn Crane entitled Pledge.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
When people are saying the pledge, they're saying, okay, I represent this country, but shouldn't they be representing people and mankind? And, you know, not just a group of politicians who try to maintain order.
When I say the Pledge of Allegiance, I figure that I'm pledging my loyalty to the country and not the government, because it's not the government that I stand for. I stand for America and the freedom and the people.
I pledge allegiance.
I really don't know what allegiance means.
Pledge allegiance.
Giving
to
respect
flag.
To the flag, which really needs to be done a lot.
I pledge allegiance to.
I don't know the meaning of the word, but I just would think it means I pledge, like, aloud, like, just proud of myself when we say that.
It's an alliance with the person. There's no treason or anything like that.
Allegiance, I think, is to be loyal and to stand by something that you think's right, and to pledge allegiance to it is to be loyal and follow it and protect it.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States.
As I've been studying history more and more, I've found it difficult to have that kind of pride, just because I've seen some of the horrible things that we've done. But then again, there are other things that make me extremely proud to be an American, and that's the right to abstain from saying the Pledge of Allegiance and be accepted as any other citizen in this country.
Indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
I think that ever since September 11th happened, it's gotten most of the kids at schools into a more positive feeling of, you know, they used to not take it so seriously because I guess they didn't understand it very much, but ever since that tragic day has happened, most kids have been taking it very seriously, and nowadays we're doing it every morning.
Yeah, we'd say it in class too, and I think it just when we, our whole school, like when September 11th happened, we all said it at the same time, and it just, like, it just makes everybody just feel better and stuff. When you say Pledge of Allegiance, it means we're still standing strong.
I think it definitely needs to be said, because not many people are very patriotic until something totally awful like the September 11th attack happens. So if kids say it every day and they understand what it means, they're going to feel more proud about their country than it's just where I live.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, and then there's like a big word, individual. Well, it's the thing that the teachers, when I was a little kid, made me do all the time, and I never really did it because for some reason maybe I have a horrible attention span, but I just never really paid attention to them doing it. So, to me, it's this procedure about America that was forced upon me that I never really did.
Okay, pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic.
I think the Pledge of Allegiance, like, symbolizes America's, it's America's, like, rhyme or something that we just go by, and it shouldn't be changed for saying under God, because most people in America are under God.
One nation 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 under God.
Under God. I just like read that in the paper a while ago, and how they're taking it out of the pledge. And when I read it, I was like, wow, that's actually kind of neat. I'm not religious. I'm probably closer to atheist or agnostic than anybody else I know. I don't pray. I don't go to church. I don't do any of that. So when I read it, I was like, wow, what a great thing. All these kids who aren't Christian aren't being made to say under God anymore. You know, I think that's a huge thing for religious rights and equality in the country.
I think the Pledge of Allegiance shouldn't be changed because most of the population in our country is Christian, and I think most people would want that to stay. That it just shows that our country is living under God, and we should keep it that way.
I don't think it's really good because people don't really have like one God. There's one God in the Pledge of Allegiance, but like East Indian people have like 10 gods.
I think that we haven't really stuck to our whole thing about separation between church and state. And I think it's kind of silly that we make a huge deal about all these things and then we don't go by them.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, and to the republic. Wait.
Can't remember how it goes. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
I believe that the pledge is more of a means of getting people to separate themselves and actually dehumanize others. Because, like, by saying the pledge, you're asserting yourself with just one little group. But if you think of people as just one race, it's a way of segregating and saying, okay, I'm better than you because I'm within this area. And I believe that what it stands for is not really something that we should be proud of.
I think everybody can make a difference, and I'm sure it helps to be over 18 when you can vote and all. As long as anybody stands up for what they believe, like I try to always, then I think you're making a difference.
I pledge allegiance.
The idea of how I could have the freedom and how everything started out was good. I am standing here right now. I don't love the government of it. I don't love all that. I love the earth that I'm standing on.
With liberty and justice for all.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be right back.